He does. He, well, he gives a whole
and now, like, you'll see what
All right, everybody, happy Hanukkah. For the web audience, we are in a different environment. We are in a tent. Hanukkah tent. This week, even though the Torah reading is from Hanukkah, from Rosh Chodesh, but for those of us who learn Chumash every day, we are living with a portion of Vayigash. Vayigash is one of those dramatic stories in the Torah. Even though we know the story, most people, when they hear it every year, they even get choked up. It's a very emotional story. How Yosef HaTzadik, with tremendous wisdom, accuses them, draws them near, Last week we finished learning how he made them feel so comfortable that he invited them to his house, and they ate together and they slept in his home. And then he planted that goblet in the luggage of Binyamin. He sent police after them. They understood that they are being accused of something that they didn't do. But as they said last week, that God, as Ho'elikim Motza es Avoyin Avodecha, that God found the inequity of his servants. In other words, they were acknowledging that whatever it is that's happening was happening because of their sin, of them selling Yosef. And Yehuda begins pleading with Yosef, that's last week, that you have to let Binyamin go back to his father. We are going to go to page 298. That's the beginning of the portion of Vayigash. The topic of tonight is going to be a very important Hasidic theme, which is describing the encounter between Yehuda and Yosef. The challenge that we have with this encounter is that last week the Torah already finished speaking about Yehuda talking to Yosef, and he was telling him that we will all be your slaves last week. And then Yosef tells Yehuda, Chalil Oli, God forbid, the one who had the goblet in him, he'll be my slave, and all of you can go in peace to your father. So we finished already speaking. The Torah was recording a conversation that Yehuda was having with Yosef. And now, page 298, in this week's portion, for the web audience, chapter 44, verse 18, Vayigash El of Yehuda. Yehuda now approaches Yosef, and he begins pleading his case. And as we know the conclusion, Yosef was unable to contain himself, and finally Yosef tells everyone to leave, and he tells his brothers that I am Yosef, your brother. The classical question is, why did the Torah have to write that Yehuda drew near, he approached Yosef, when they were already in the middle of a conversation? Question. That's everyone's question. And therefore there are many meanings of Yehuda approaching Yosef. Being that tonight is Hanukkah, and we celebrate Hanukkah primarily for the miracle of the oil, which that in itself is a tremendous message. One would say, you know, if God forbid, if the Chashmonaim would have lost the battle, Judaism wouldn't have existed today. We would have been done, God forbid. If the miracle of the oil wouldn't have happened, then what? We wouldn't have had oil. But what do we celebrate? We celebrate the miracle of the oil because there is something in this miracle which is much greater than the victory that we had militarily. And the miracle which we do celebrate is the miracle that oil, which normally is needed to give fuel to the fire, somehow there was a little amount of oil and the fire burned for as long as we needed it to burn.
This was for the menorah? The oil was burning?
Yeah. So there has to be a certain common thread, there has to be a certain common theme between the portion and the miracle of Hanukkah. So I want to just suggest that one of the more Kabbalistic, the Hasidic explanations of why did Yehuda have to go near Yosef, what was he approaching Yosef if they were already talking together? So this approaching doesn't mean physically approaching, but there was another meaning behind this approach, that is very much connected to the miracle of Hanukkah. And the concept is more or less as follows. The word Yehuda, the name of Yehuda, Yehuda means to acknowledge. It comes from the word of Hoida'a, acknowledging. Specifically in Kabbalah, refers to a person recognizing his or her own limitation and acknowledging that there is something which is beyond them. Which is why, traditionally, when we say the words in the prayers, Modim, which is Hoida'a, so we bow down, we put our heads down. This is just a physical expression of the concept of acknowledging, you know, there's acknowledging that you exist, I exist and you exist, but the real acknowledging is that there's something which is beyond me, which is greater than me, to which I put my head down. In the words of Kabbalah, that's the concept of bittul, of a person nullifying oneself in a healthy way.
He also said that's the way we should start the prayer.
We wake up in the morning, the first words we say is modeh, which is hoida'a, which is Yehuda, which is acknowledging that there's something greater than us. Our minig chabad is the chazan, really begins with the words hodu, which is the beginning of the prayer 100%, that we begin with the concept of hoida'a, not acknowledging that God exists, but in Kabbalah it means the feeling of self-nullification, that I feel like I'm nothing in front of God. Before we take the three steps back, it says in Shulchan Aruch that the basic mental preparation for the Shmona Esrei is to contemplate the greatness of God and the smallness of man. That's hoida'a. That concept of a person being able to nullify oneself played itself out in Yehuda's life by the story that was recorded with Yehuda and Tamar, that Yehuda had a relationship with Tamar that wasn't appropriate, and she was tried and found guilty for being pregnant with a strange man. And she did not want to ashamed. She had certain personal articles from Yehuda. And she said that, listen, the man to whom these articles belong to, he was the one that is the father of my children. If Yehuda wouldn't have this capability, this ability of bittul, of being able to nullify oneself, I mean, this was a challenging moment. For Yehuda to be able to say, Tzotka, she's right, me many, I'm the man, that was a tremendous expression of his nullification, that he was able to nullify himself, hoida'a. In Kabbalah, the concept of hoida'a is also expressed when we keep the commandments, particularly the commandments that we don't enjoy nor understand. So the commitment to keep the mitzvahs doesn't mean I'll understand it and I'll keep it. It means regardless whether I understand it or not, I'm going to keep it. For that, a person has to have a certain measure of hoida'a, of Yehuda, of a Jew. Jew comes from Judah, to be able to nullify oneself. Of course, I want to understand, I want to feel, but bittul, I'm here, I'm committed. If I am in the mood or not, I'm doing the mitzvah. That's Yehuda. Yosef represents the opposite of Yehuda. The word Yosef in Hebrew comes from the word to add, it's addition, to become greater. Gedula, Yosef was a great man, he was extremely intelligent, and his intelligence didn't stay contained with him, but he shared it. The entire country benefited from his innovation, from his application of his innovation. And therefore, in Kabbalah, Yosef represents the virtue of Torah, the virtue of understanding, the virtue of passion, and not only understanding and keeping it to yourself, but sharing the joy, sharing the warmth, giving to others the passion and the understanding that you have. This is what Yosef represents. So it's basically the constant back and forth, what is greater, learning Torah, keeping the commandments? What is greater, expressing yourself when you keep the mitzvah, or nullifying oneself when you keep the mitzvah? This challenge, this back and forth is really the difference between Yosef and Yehuda. And when it says that Vayigash Elov Yehuda, that Yehuda came to Yosef in Kabbalah, that means that Yehuda was trying to implant inside Yosef HaTzadik a little bit of his quality, which is the quality of being humble. Yehuda knew that if Yosef would be a bit more humble, he might be forgiving. See, rationally, Yosef was right. Someone stole his cup. They themselves had said, whoever has the cup in their possession will be a servant. And so will the rest of us be a servant. And Yosef said, no, whoever stole it will be my servant. The rest of you can go home. That's a rational position to take. What was Yehuda's counter? What did Yehuda do? He didn't challenge that rationale. He didn't come with a rational argument, but according to Kabbalah, he was trying to make Yosef be a bit more humble, and he felt if he would be a bit more humble, so then he'll be able to open up his heart and be more compassionate. He was appealing to his rachmanis, but all of that comes when you put your reason on the side. Because rationally, Yosef's argument, which was Binyamin should stay and be my slave, was the rational argument to make. Okay, good. This is the way we understand his approaching the other. Now, something very interesting happened here in the background. Let me give you a little bit of a medrash. When Yosef revealed himself, and Yosef told the brothers, I'm Yosef. And then the brothers had this terrible challenge of letting their father know that Yosef was alive. They also needed to have a tremendous amount of Yehuda in them. Because Yosef is alive, how did he get there? Sooner or later, and it was sooner rather than later, Yaakov figured out what happened. So it was very humbling for them to admit to the crime that they did. And aside of the humility that they needed, they were challenged by shocking Yaakov. Practically, they were afraid to let Yaakov know that Yosef is living. Even when they let him know, the Torah says, Vayofag Levi, that he questioned them, he didn't believe them. And what made Yaakov believe that Yosef is living? Who knows?
Send the granddaughter ahead?
No. The wagons. So first, the granddaughter, Serach Bas Asher, the way they notified him was by playing up the song, singing the song that Yosef is still living. But they made it into a melody, into a song. But the Torah says that he saw the wagons, and he knew that Yosef is alive, and Batechi Ruach Yaakov, and Yaakov's spirit became alive. What was the mitzvah with the wagons?
That's the last thing that he studied.
Why was that the last thing that he studied?
Because of the sheep, no?
What's the sheep?
Yeah.
So Medrash, there's a little bit of info that in yeshiva they don't teach, I don't know why. So the Rashi says in Chumash that he sent him wagons with young calves. And those young calves was a reminder to Yaakov regarding the last Torah class they had together. What was the last thing they learned together? So you have to know the story behind it. Why did Yosef leave his father? Because his father asked him to go find out how they're doing. So he went out. Now there's a mitzvah when someone comes to visit you, aside of giving them food and drink, right? Eishel, achila, shesiyam, what's the lamed? So lamed either means lina, or it means levia, which means you have to escort them. Now today, it's appropriate, and a person fulfills that mitzvah by simply escorting them outside of your home. For even, you know, very superficially, inside your house, as humble as you are, and as giving and sharing, it's your house. So, you're in my house. On the street, we're both equals. So this being hospitable and this making you feel, you know, equal is truly done when I walk out with you on the street, and when we part as equals, not as me being the guy that's doing the favor and you being the recipient of the favor. Walking out is enough today. Really, in the olden days, or when you live in dangerous places, the concept of accompanying someone is to protect them. You know, there's a certain safety in numbers. When Yaakov sent Yosef to go see how his brothers are doing, since Yaakov went out of the city, Yosef went out, Yaakov went with him. He was accompanying him. So Yosef told his father, "I don't understand. You sent me, so you shouldn't be troubled, right? I'm here to help you find out how the brothers are doing, how your sons are doing. Why are you walking with me?" So Yaakov told him, "It's a mitzvah." So he asked him, where do you see there's such a mitzvah?" So Yaakov told him this law that if, God forbid, a person is found murdered outside the city, and we don't know who the person, who was the murderer, so you can't say, since we don't know who did it, the case is closed. No. If you don't know who the murderer was, the responsibility falls on society. Why should the responsibility fall on the greater society? Because if he would have been received in the nearest city, and if that person would have been given food, and if that person would have been given something to drink and a place for it to sleep, or if at least someone would have walked with him, then perhaps he wouldn't have gotten murdered. So why are the elders of the city, representing the city, why are they responsible to go through some type of a kapara that you have to seek atonement? Because they have to say, perhaps we didn't accompany him. So that was, Yaakov was teaching him the law of the egla aruf, of decapitating the calf. Yaakov was doing that just to explain to his son why I'm walking with you. Just Yosef found it very ironic. You know, you send me on a mission, and you're going with me. So when Yaakov finished explaining that to them, they were way out there. So they had a long Torah class, and they went into all the details, and it was meant to be. So Yaakov really went a big part of the way with Yosef. So that was the last thing that they learned. Now, it wasn't only the last thing, that's what the Medrash says. And Rashi quotes a part of it. That was the last thing that he learned, so when he sent him a Tzion calf to remind him of the Egla Rufa, and aha, it is Yosef, because that was the last thing that we learned together. The concept of sending someone out there and going along with him for him to be protected. And if you don't do that, then you're responsible. The one who sends is responsible for the person who he sent. Mystically has a very deep significance to the whole mission of Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef was the first one in Egypt, before all of the brothers. Why it happened, we know the story, but on a deeper level, Yosef had in him something that the brothers didn't. Only Yosef would have been able, and indeed, was in Egypt for many years and never got disconnected from Yiddishkeit. What empowered Yosef to be in Egypt and never to stop learning Torah? What is it that he had?
That Yisod?
So if we're comparing the quality of Yosef versus Yehuda, Yehuda is humble, I'm committed whether I like it or not, versus understanding what I'm doing, learning Torah. So in as much as you're right in the beginning of the day, we have to start with the commitment. We're doing it regardless. But for the long run, how many people, okay, how long can you go without the passion? How long can you go without understanding? Most people will begin strong, but then they get weak. And every now and then they need to get some inspiration. So it's not Nasa, it's Nasa the Nishma, because the Nishma, so Yosef was somehow by the divine plan, the one in Egypt, not only the one first, but he ended up being the provider, because the power that is needed to live in the exile without physically being with Yaakov, but for Yaakov to still be with him, spiritually Yaakov accompanied Yosef, there was Leviah the whole time, was because Yaakov taught Yosef Torah. So he always had the Torah with him. So if he had the Torah with him, he was always connected to the understanding of Yiddishkeit, and because of that he had more passion in Yiddishkeit, and that gave him the power to withstand all of the temptations and the trials and to stay a good, faithful Jew regardless of the circumstances. All that, this is a classical theme about the power
and
about
Yosef.
And that was the uniqueness of Yosef. So therefore, because when you have Torah, Yaakov indeed accompanied him, correct. How did he accompany him? By imparting the knowledge of the Torah. And Yosef was the one that had the majority of the knowledge of Torah, more than any other of the brothers. He was the Ben Zikun. Okay, and therefore, for to go ahead and to convince Yosef, for Yehuda to convince Yosef that my quality is greater than yours, or you need to learn something from me, that was Yosef was hesitant. So going back, this Vayigash El of Yehuda, Yehuda needed to approach him. Yehuda needed to show him that he indeed has something that Yosef doesn't, knowing that Yosef has something that Yehuda doesn't, knowing that Yosef was the only one that would have been able to live in Egypt as he did without compromising one inch on his Yiddishkeit. The opposite, he grew in Yiddishkeit, he learned more, and he had a family, and he taught Torah to his children. He was growing a Jewish family, the only Jewish family in Egypt, a religious, warm Torah family. That was because of his quality of being connected and constantly learning Torah. We're learning Torah, we are understanding, we're connected to the source. The source, God is with us. You know, the first word of the Ten Commandments is Anoichi. Anoichi means Ano, Nafshi, Kesavis, Yehavis, I. God says, I put myself in the words of the Torah. So God is with us by learning. Okay.
So you can't do the opposite.
Which is?
To wait till you understand something to take it on.
God forbid.
You have to
begin with Yehuda. Right. Yosef knew that. But he knew that Yehuda is the beginning. But after you have the healthy foundation of Hoida'ah, now you have Yosef. Yeah, Yehuda is Kabbalah soil, and Yosef is Tam Vadas. And now Yehuda is approaching Yosef, telling Yosef that after all of your learning, you have to come back to me. I'm coming to you. You have to embrace my quality. And how did he convince him? Why would Yosef be open to that? Why indeed is it true that even after the quality of Torah learning, not only do we begin with Moedim, Moeda'ani, but at the end we have to end with Yehuda? And as we know that historically, this is the classical Hasidic themes, that the Jewish kings ultimately need to be a descendant from David, from Yehuda, even though that it wasn't so in the beginning. Here in this week's Parsha, you have a Yosef being the king. But at the end of days, the quality of Yehuda is going to be even greater than the... it's going to be even greater than the quality. The question is, why is that? So I want to propose the following idea, something very interesting. So I want to go to the end of the portion. And this is very interesting. You know, page 314. And for the web audience, we're going to chapter 47, verse 12. 314 in our Chumash. 314, verse 13. But Pedek, Mem Zayin, chapter 47, verse 13. The Torah occasionally does not follow chronological order. There's a lot of debates about that. But it's undeniable that there are certain times that the Torah doesn't follow chronological order. Many people who are uncomfortable with that, they fight tooth and nail whenever they could to say that everything is the right chronological order. After the Torah writes that Yaakov came down to Egypt, the whole story, and the brothers came down to Egypt. And by the way, parenthetically, you know, when it says that Pari, what happened when Jacob met Pari? What did Pari ask him? He asked him,
How old are you?
Why did he ask him, how old are you?
He looked old.
Because he looked old. But Okay, and therefore, and if he would have been old? Now, why was Potty interested in his age? You know, sometimes when we don't know how to make conversation, we think it's a good opener. How old are you?
Mm-hmm.
Potty was a chacham. Potty was a wise person. There was something behind the question.
How long he has left to be with you?
Why?
Because he brought blessing
Yosef's dream was that there's going to be 7 years of hunger. At the end of this week's portion, beginning of verse 13, the Torah says, "V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz." There was no bread. Because kichavid harav ma'ay, because there was a terrible hunger. When did this hunger happen?
Before.
So chronological. Oh, so you have a whole debate about this. So like this, the Torah wrote that it was after 2 years. No, let's go. After 2 years, we came down to Egypt 2 years into the hunger. If you read the verses literally, other people don't ask. It's not for now. They turn everything on the head to make everything fit because they have to make it work on the order. Now, according to most people, what happened when Yaakov came to Egypt? When Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, when he stood in front of the Nile, now Egypt functions with the water of the Nile. What happened? Why was there a drought? Because there was hardly any water in the Nile. When Yaakov came to the Nile, Rashi says the waters of the Nile raised up. Not only that, they irrigated the lands. So Pari saw that Yaakov, being in Egypt, he's a wise man. He's pushing, taking away the famine. But he got nervous. Why did he get nervous? Because Yaakov looked very old. So he pushed it. It was a practice. How long are you going to be here for, my friend? For me to get worried. To know what we're going to do with the hunger wasn't that good. And what did Yaakov answer him? It was Gavalik, according to this. He told him that I'm 130 years old, that my years are few and bad. What was he trying to tell him? And I didn't come near the age of my father. Yaakov's father lived until 80. We have a tradition that when you 5 years before, 5 years after the years of one's parent, Yaakov was 130. How many years did he have until 180? 50 years, even if it's 5 years, 45 years. He told Pari, don't worry, there's a medrash that says that Adam Arishan, after the primordial sin, Adam Arishan separated himself from Chava for how many years? 130 years. And those 130 years he lived in sin, whatever that means. He didn't live with his wife. Yaakov's, and it says that the beauty of Yaakov, the Gemara says, that Shufre de Yaakov is Me'ein Shufre de Adam Arishan. So Yaakov really is rectifying the 130 years of Adam. So when Yaakov is telling Pari, he was telling him two things. He understood his question. You're nervous. I look very old. I'm about to go. He told him, don't worry. He told him, my years are few and they're bad, but that's because I need to make up for the sins of Adam. But Adam only sinned for 130 years. So my bad life is over. How old was my father? 180. I'm far away from 180. So he answered his question. He told him they have nothing to worry about. You know, people with tzaras cannot live long. But he told them, my tzaras are over, and I'm far away from my parents' age, so I'm going to have a long life, which, relative, he didn't live to 180, but he lived the years that the Torah says. He lived another 17 years, as we're going to learn in Emirat Hashem next week. That was their conversation. Point is that if this is the reading, the way Rashi reads it, notice, for when Yaakov came into Egypt, what happened? The hunger stopped. So here, the Torah like goes back.
Like a summary.
But there has to be a reason. In other words, why wouldn't the Torah write this beforehand? And what does the Torah write? So the Torah writes, V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz, there was no bread because of the hunger. And the Torah begins explaining to us how not only Egyptians, how the entire world came to Egypt for bread. Right? Verse 14, V'yelakit Yosef es kol ha'kesev, that Yosef gathered all of the silver that was found in the land of Egypt. And not only in the land of Egypt, but in the land of Canaan. Etc, etc, etc. Now, there's a Gemara. The Gemara has a big contradiction. Same page. The Gemara is in the tractate of Pesachim. Page 119. Kuf Yud Tes. And the Gemara there is quoting this verse. That when it says that Yosef gathered all of the monies. And the Gemara elaborates. Omar Rabbi Yehuda, Omar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Kol, look at this big statement. Kol kesev zov sheba oilam, that all of the silver and all of the gold of the entire world, Yosef loktu, Yosef gathered, Vehevio Mitzrayma, and he brought it into Egypt. Shenemar vayalakit Yosef is kol kesev, etc., etc. And then he says that when the Jew Ushaolu Yisrael ni Mitzrayim, so when we left Egypt, and the Torah says, "Vayinatzlu etz Mitzrayim," that we emptied out Egypt. And the Gemara quotes different opinions. Rav Asi says we made Egypt like a trap that traps birds or animals. And the way you trap them is that you put grain in it. So they went in to get the grain, and then you trap them. But if there's no grain left, you won't trap anything. So we left Egypt like a trap without grain, or like a fish trap without any fish. Like the depths of the sea without any fish. There's not a whole meaning behind what's this and what's that, but we emptied out Egypt. So the Gemara clearly states that all of the money went into Egypt, and when we left Mitzrayim, we took all of the money out with us. Azoy. Mamash, a few lines later, for people who look up in the Gemara, by the two dots, Omar Rav Chama and Rav Chanina. Rav Chama says in the name of Rav Chanina. Rav Chama Bar Chanina says, Shalosh matmoyne yois kitmin yosef b'mitzrayim. Yosef hid three huge treasures in Egypt. Three treasures. One of the treasures were revealed to Korach. Achas nizgal l'Korach. Va'achas nizgal l'Antoninus. Rabbi Yehuda, the one who wrote the Mishnah, who lived in Tiberias, was a great friend of the Roman general in charge of the whole Holy Land. His name was Antoninus. Antoninus was such a dear friend to Rebbe that Antoninus dug a tunnel. This we learned in the tractate of Avodah Zarah. And he used to go underground every day to learn Torah by Rebbe. And the Gemara Nach says details, he was scared people are going to find out. He took with him two slaves, two servants, and he killed them every time. Shouldn't be any evidence that he went to learn Torah. One he killed when he dropped off, one he killed when he went back. The whole Gemara that the Rebbe asked him, he told the Rebbe, no one is allowed to be here. And one day someone was there, and he got very mad at the Rebbe. He told the Rebbe, you know, I killed the guys. I'm gonna. So Rebbe says, you killed your guys? What are you talking about? You don't. And Rebbe resuscitated. Rebbe called in the guard who he killed. Rebbe told him, nah, you didn't kill him. He's here. He's talking. And so he. Gavaldic. Anyways, so this is Antoninus. So the second one Antoninus found, and the third treasure, Va'achaz Genuzal L'Tzadikim Lo'asalovi. The third treasure is hidden for Tzadikim, for the world to come. Okay. So we began the class saying that there has to be a connection between the portion and Chanukah. I have the following suggestion. First of all, everyone asks the contradiction. First of all, in the Talmud, it's not a big deal. You know, one opinion, and there's another opinion. But if you can put both opinions together, it's even better. So first the Gemara says that all of the money went to Egypt, and then we took everything out. We took everything out, we left nothing in there. It was like a trap without the bait. It was like the Metzula, the depths of the sea without fish. And then Rav Chama says, you kidding? The treasures, two-thirds are... Korach found one. That means that two-thirds of the money stayed there. Hidden, but it's there. But I think that you can put them both together. The Ben Ish Chai, which was a great Sephardic rabbi, he wrote a few books. So I began reading it. I just want to repeat something. This is Kabbalah stuff. So take it the way you want it. And he writes like this. He asks, how did Yosef HaTzadik have such success? Whatever he did, he was successful. He was 60, he was from in his family, he was the most successful. Then when he was a servant, successful. He was in jail. So wherever he went, he was Leah. So he says, Kabbalah words, he says that he knew the secret behind a divine combination. There's a certain divine name, and this is the name. Kesa, you can write it down, it's very interesting. Chof, Samachay, all these divine names are three-letter names. And the other name is Bapoz. Beis, Pei, Zion. And he writes like this, that if you take these two divine names, this is not part of the shame up. I don't know what shame this is. These two words play with the letters and you'll see that they spell out Kesev and Zahav. The letters of gold and silver, if you rearrange them, they form this type of divine combination. I don't know what that means, but there's a secret behind these combinations. Kesev Apos. And he writes, Kesev Apos have the numerical value of 174. And he writes that Yosef had something called Chen. He was successful because he had Chen. Not that he wasn't smart. He was smart, and he was good, and he was honest. Without all of these qualities, if the insides are not good, we say Sheker Achen. But if a person has all of the real qualities, and on top of that, you have Chen, so Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu was pleading our cause to God, what did he say? Inno Motzasi Chen Benecha. So Chen, Yosef HaTzadik was a tzadik. But why was he so successful? Because aside of him being a tzaddik, he had chen. Now, he writes about chen, and he says that chen times 3 is 174. That's the Venishchai, Adkan Venishchai. So he had the secret of Kesev Apoz, and that is equals 3 times chen. So I want to suggest that the 3 treasures are the 3 chens. Now, Noach had chen. Now I want to explain something about what that means, the way I understand it. Yosef HaTzadik, what was he? He was the concept of Torah learning, understanding. He was a chacham, he was a novi, he had chacham, he had bina, he was a wise person. He had the knowledge of Torah, he understood what he's doing. He had a plan, there's a hunger. Chen, what gave Yosef chen, is something which is very difficult to define. Chen in English, it's grace, it's charisma, magnetism. What is it? It's something which is hidden. It's a hidden quality. And I want to perhaps suggest that Yosef HaTzadik began grasping that which Yehuda was trying to give him, which is the quality of Bittul. And the reason why the Torah writes it at the end of the portion, even though according to most commentators this happened before the end of the first 2 years, was because Yosef didn't really get this chen. It took him a while to understand. When Yehuda approached him, he was hesitant, but ultimately he received, he accepted the quality of Yehuda, and that gave him chen. Let me give you a little bit of an intro.
He was successful way before that. He was successful in everything before that. He was Mishnah Melech already.
Nothing near as what he was successful over here. To be able to get the entire gold and silver of the world in here. Now there's the physical success, and then there is gold and silver, what they represent spiritually. So Kesa is love to God, and Zav is awe of God. There are certain high levels of being connected to God that you can only get when you're Yehuda. But let me give you another small introduction to this. And this week's Parsha, I know this is about Ben Ishchai, but there's a big, when you say Shemona Esrei, so we're supposed to say it silently. Are you supposed to hear what you're saying? We just had this discussion. I'm saying Mamash.
No. You're yourself to hear.
So you have to open up the Zohar, and this week he writes that when you pray Shemona Esrei, you're not even supposed to hear yourself talking. The Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, halachically, most halachic opinions today rule otherwise. They say that when you pray the Shemona Esrei, you're supposed to pray it silently, but you should hear what you're saying. But you have people, especially people that have their that base themselves more on Kabbalah, when they daven Shemona Esrei, they don't even hear what they're saying. What's the meaning behind this debate? So the Rebbe has a beautiful essay about this debate. And the point is like this, that there are two parts to prayer. There is the communicating that takes place during prayer. I want to communicate to God. And then there is the unification. There is the I am with God. I'm bond with God. I'm united with God. That happens during prayer. Both parts of prayer are very important. We know that in human relationships, you need both. You need communication. And you need to be together. Sometimes you can be together and not say a word, that's good. But you need both. Just to be together without saying a word won't work. And just saying many words without being together also won't work. You have to have both. The debate whether you need to hear your own words during Shmona Esrei or not, the Rebbe explains, is basically the debate, what is the main part of the tefillah? If the main part of prayer is communicating to God, then it makes more sense that you should hear what you're saying. Communicating, you're talking. If the main part of prayer is the standing in front of God, it happens also, if you're already standing in front of God, why not communicate? Why not think? Why not ask? But if the main point of prayer is just to be bonded with God, then the talking is of lesser significance. And the Rebbe says even more than that. When there is communication going on, for you to communicate, you need to be, you need to exist. When a person is becoming united with God, we're uniting with God, we're not uniting with an equal. The more united we get to God, what happens? The more nothing we become. So this debate, this difference between Yosef and Yehuda, is the same question between, is the talking or is it quiet? What's Yehuda's quality? To be quiet. So the Rebbe asks a very big question. He says, based on that explanation, and by the way, this is before his explanation, the Zohar writes that you have to daven, you should not even hear your own words. He writes, the Zohar concludes that when Mashiach is going to come, we're going to pray the Shmona Esrei loud. So how do you explain that? What logic is there to that? And if when Mashiach is going to come, there's going to be a greater revelation of the Divine Presence, so we should be even more nullified.
If you're truly one, then you're both parts.
Okay. So the Rebbe explains that when you are, there's two types of nullification. There is the nullification that I'm nothing, and then there's the nullification that I become the thing to which or to whom I am nullified to. When a prophet talked, how does prophecy work? So when it says that those are the words that the Shekhinah speaks through the throat of Moshe Rabbeinu, for a prophet to receive prophecy, they have to be in a total state of bittul, to the point that aside of Moshe Rabbeinu, the other prophets physically were unable to stay standing when they received prophecy. They used to fall in a certain position. Partially, not like we by Davin, you know, we know we're supposed to bow down. The body went into a position because they became nothing in front of God. So if a prophet is nothing, if he's totally overawed by God, then how is he talking? What's the answer? He's not talking. God talking. So when it says that when Mashiach is going to come, we're going to be davening loud, that's not because prayer is going to change. Prayer is really bittul. And Al-Pi Kabbalah, prayer is more to become one with God than to communicate to God. But we're going to reach today the highest level of bittul, of nullification, is that I'm not. I'm totally not, so I'm silent. When Mashiach will come, everyone will achieve a greater level of bittul, which is unachievable today, that will become so nothing, that will become part of God. And once we become part of God, what happens? God begins to work through us. But what is speaking through us? Not our words, God's words. Not only speaking, understanding, we'll understand. It won't be our knowledge, it's going to be God's knowledge. So I want to just connect that perhaps that when Yehuda is approaching Yosef, that means Yosef is lacking something. And at the end of the parsha, we're beginning to learn about Yehuda accessing all of the wealth of the world, all of the gold and silver in Kabbalah always represent a certain level of love to God, which is silver, and gold is connected to a certain amount of yira, of awe of God. So Yosef was getting it. He was receiving it. And even physically, why did people give him the money? Why were they giving him the money? Because they needed something, they had a need, and they acknowledged it. It's a humbling thing. And the Torah goes into detail, they became really humble. First they gave away their money, and then they ran out of money. So what did they do? Gave away the animals, and then when they ran out of animals, they gave away themselves, land. They land, and they became slaves.
Yeah.
So there's a tremendous amount of bittul going on. So Yosef is collecting their bittul. He's collecting, he's seeing, he's trying to learn something from it. It wasn't just, I'm becoming wealthy. He's watching people give everything away. And what happened at the end? What did Yosef tell them? He moved them around and they all became subservient to the king. When they became subservient to the king, what did that do to them? What would it do to many people? It makes you feel like a loser. They were not humiliated. Yosef HaTzadik saw that when this happened by him, those people were productive people. They didn't go out like losers. They survived. They worked. They made an agreement. They kept some for themselves. They gave some to Potty. They gave a fifth, 20% belonged to the government. So Yosef began to see that through bittul doesn't have to end in you being nothing in the negative sense, in the positive negative sense, but bittul that you accept, you become an extension of Potty. They became happy campers. They became workers for Potty. When Yosef realized that, Yosef began to tap into great levels of him connecting to God. Until now, his connection to God was through Torah. He began to realize that he can connect to God through bittul, but not that the bittul is going to mean he won't understand. The opposite. If you have real bittul, just like the Zohar writes in prayer, so when you pray, when Mashiach will come, you'll pray loud. If you have real bittul, you know what's going to happen? You'll understand infinitely more. Not your understanding. You don't exist. God's understanding. You're going to have an emotional experience infinitely greater than what you had until now. Only because you have bittul. So today, bittul means you're nothing. In a positive way. We put our feelings aside. We put our understanding aside. We're simple servants for Hashem. Finished. The secret, the treasure of bittul, and there are three levels of that in Kabbalah, is such a great level that through bittul you become a greater Yosef. Why does oil get consumed? So there's fire and the fire is eating the oil. The oil has to sacrifice itself. It has to give itself up. What happened during Hanukkah? The oil didn't become less because the fire was burning. Giving yourself up to Hashem won't make you less. I want to try to reconcile this Gemara by saying that even though the Gemara began by telling us that the Jewish people took all of the money out of Egypt, perhaps just for Tuesday night class, that's Emes, we took all the money out of Egypt and the money still stayed in Egypt. And these three treasures. It was a secret money that stayed there. You can take and you can take and you can take. Today, if there's 100 and I take 50, how much do you have left? 50. What's the miracle of Hanukkah that I'm taking? I'm taking 50 and there's still 100 left. It burns the whole night and the whole thing is left. So you can take everything out of Egypt, and there can be treasures left in Egypt. Those treasures are treasures that Yosef experienced through bittul, through Yehuda, not through Yosef. And if you analyze, we don't have time for this now, but Korach and Antoninus and the Tzadikim La'asad Lavi, the whole argument of Korach was because he felt that everyone is equal. Why is everyone equal? Doesn't Moshe Rabbeinu know more Torah than everyone else? Yes. But Korach, you learn Chassidus, Korach made his rebellion because he claimed that Yehuda is greater than Yosef. If Yehuda is greater than Yosef, Yehuda is the concept of Bittul. Everyone is, when you're nothing, you can't be a greater nothing than someone else. Either you're nothing or you're something. You can be a lesser or a greater something, but nothing is nothing. So in nothingness, we're all equal. So Korach's treasure, of course he was also wealthy, but he accessed, he experienced the bittul, the secret bittul of Yosef, which gave him tremendous amount of chen.
But this is the lower level.
This is the lowest level of the tree. He didn't know how to apply it. And the same thing with Antoninus. Can you imagine the Roman emperor of Israel to go and learn Torah by Rebbe? The Romans were the superpower. And these were the oppressed Jews. And instead of him being the emperor and Rebbe being the subservient, in that chamber, you know who the king was? Rebbe was the king. What kind of bittul Antoninus needed for that? Tremendous bittul. But he was afraid for his life, because if anyone would have found out, forget about him losing his position, he could have been killed. So he killed the servants. It wasn't out of evil. He was putting himself in life danger to go learn Torah. So by him also there was a tremendous amount of bittul. It didn't make him lesser, it made him greater. Even physically, Korach was wealthy, and Antoninus was wealthy, and the tzaddikim are going to be wealthy. So the message of Chanukah, or the secret of Chanukah is that in the world that we know of, in our world, you have to choose between one or the other. And we fluctuate back and forth. We start the day with humility. We try to understand to the best of our ability. It's very important. We try to feel to the best of our ability. Yosef. But we need to know that at the end, we're going back to Yehuda. So the question is, any kids ever tell you why? Do I have to go into pajamas? Anyways, tomorrow morning I have to get dressed again. Why should I make an effort to understand if I'm beginning with the acknowledgement that it's greater than me, that God is transcending of me, and I'll never fully understand it? And at the end of my knowledge, I'm going to get to the same thing, right? So why make an effort to understand? It must be because the Yehuda that comes after Yosef is much greater than the Yehuda that comes. How can that be? That's the question. If you're nothing, you're nothing. Answer is no. You can be nothing. The greater level of nothing is that you become that to whom you are nothing for. That's the right word in English. It's probably not. But if it's bittul for Hashem, so the higher level of bittul is like a prophet, that you become part of Hashem in a good way, not God forbid in a wrong way. And that increases your knowledge infinitely. And that increases your emotional capacity infinitely. Infinitely means infinitely. So it is limitless. Once you become part of Hashem, there's Ein Sof. There's no limit. So the oil gave oil, gave oil, gave oil, gave oil. And the Torah only writes it at the end of the Parsha because it took Yosef a long time to get there. And when he got it, he got something. And he knew that this is a treasure. And he realized that this treasure we will all merit truly, as the Gemara says, La'asad Lavi, and then we're not going to abuse it. So Korach was the worst off. Antoninus was good, but he wasn't that great. And La'asad Lavi will have the capacity of having both Yosef and Yehuda together. Mm-hmm. But who's going to be the king? Yehuda's going to be the king. David is going to be the king. Because the greatness will be the greatness of Bittul. Okay, so I'll tell you Kabbalah words. But you have to. The Kabbalah words are that you take the 10 spheres, and you have the lowest emotions. Netzachoyt Yisoyd and Malchus. So it's having that experience through Bittul. That was Korach. Then you have Chagas, was Antoninus. And then you have the three highest ones, the Chabad, the full understanding, which says that when Mashiach will come, that the world is going to be filled with the knowledge of God, and that means that we're going to mamish have divine wisdom. How can we have divine wisdom? Because we'll be nothing, so we'll be able to have divine wisdom. That's Mashiach. Mm-hmm.